Hey y'all, Sam here. Thanks for tuning in to Party Girls. Feel free to follow us on Instagram at party.girls.pod and check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/partygirls, where you can subscribe to our show and become a member of our Discord community. Thanks, y'all. Hey y'all, thanks for tuning in to Party Girls this week. I'm Sam Beard.
I'm Jamie Peck.
And we'll be covering the burgeoning student movement for Palestinian liberation that's sort of swept the nation over the past 5 days or so. We have a guest on who is a Columbia organizer, and Jamie and I will talk a little bit about the timeline of this new student movement, as well as some of the historical roots that it might be influenced by or could garner some tactical and strategic and theoretical lessons from.
Hell yeah. This is so exciting. I love that tweet you showed me about how, you know, all the ultras who love occupying shit are like, oh, fuck yeah, this is our time to shine, baby. This is our favorite thing. Fwah, 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 fwah. Pew, 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 pew. So yeah, let's fucking go.
Go get him, Tiger.
Love that. So first up, we have an interview that we're very excited about. This, we're excited on multiple levels, right? Because it is our first interview ever as a podcast. Our first guest. And I guess it's not our first three-way pod because we had Andrew talk about some stuff with us before, but definitely our first guest from someone outside the PG crew. And we're very, very stoked to be talking to someone who is inside the gates of Columbia right now, talking as we speak. So that was pretty cool. And I really liked the up-to-date perspective that she had to share with us.
Yes, me too. Very fortunate for that. It was very nice to see them.
So without further ado, here's our interview with a student organizer that we will refer to for the purposes of our show as C.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me and for hosting.
Thank you for being here. To kick things off, let's start at the beginning. What kind of planning went into organizing this encampment? And what were some pivotal moments leading up to its official start?
Yeah, so the planning had actually taken place over a significant amount of time, several weeks in the making. We specifically knew that we wanted to produce something that would take place during the week when President Manu Shafiq would testify before Congress. And I will say that the primary efforts were centered and forefronted by QUAD, which is a Columbia University Apartheid Divest, SJP, and JVP.
How has it gone? How is it going? Has anything surprised you? What did you expect to happen? Yeah.
So our primary efforts were concentrated on taking the East Lawn and setting up encampment there. We were specifically aiming for people to camp out starting at 4 o'clock in the morning because we anticipated an early morning sweep. Columbia tends to be pretty dictatorial when it comes to their tactics, very harsh, very regressive. So we definitely didn't anticipate the first encampment to last as long as it did. Eventually, when it got swept by the NYPD, people kind of spontaneously moved to the West Lawn. It was a very organic movement. I think people are feeling very excited and mobilized by this spurt of like curiosity and mobilization and political education. Although, because the movement has now significantly grown in numbers, we're not quite sure what to do with all the enthusiasm that is present and funnel it into a channel that will be both politically and personally progressive for both at the individual level and at the collective level.
Yeah, I definitely want to come back to that question at the end, because we're both really interested, I think, in where you see this movement going or where you would like to see it go. But has there been any notable presence of right-wing counter-protesters at Columbia? I was there the other day. I didn't see any, but, they tend to take up an outsized amount of space in the news media and social media. has there been a presence of right-wing counter-protesters? If so, what has it been like?
So we do have a smattering of pro-Israel students who will come heckle the camp or actually walk into the camp with the Israeli flag, or they're walking along the perimeter trying to film people and take photographs of them. So the presence is notable, but it's pathetic. So their numbers are quite low. I would say the most vocal person who is involved in like anti-Palestinian protest is Shai Davidai, who's a professor in the business school at Columbia. He has quite a big following on Twitter. So he always is making calls to actions, which are usually not fruitful, and we can curb before they happen. So a couple days ago, Shai was trying to come to the center of the encampment on the West Lawn. And funnily enough, when he tried to swipe his ID in, because Columbia has instituted the security policy where in order to enter the campus, you have to swipe your student ID at the door, the COO of student operations had deactivated his ID. And I think Talia Jane, the reporter, had actually filmed him the exact moment when he realizes that his ID is deactivated and he just throws a tantrum. It's quite funny.
It's unfortunate that was caught on camera, because prior to that incident, Jamie, you had more followers than this guy on Twitter, but he has just surpassed you now.
Oh no. All the really cool people who are still left on Twitter are following him and not me. That was a hilarious video. I saw it too.
And like, why did they do that, I guess? I mean, it seems like there were multiple, like a lot of faculty had their IDs deactivated or something like that. Do you know was it just him or was it something that's happening more?
So actually, the people who have their IDs deactivated are suspended students. The university definitely doesn't want those suspended students back on campus. And this actually directly ties to the initial encampment on the East Lawn, where an oversight of ours is that a lot of the people who got arrested were main organizers of the movement. So for a moment there, our strategy was lacking. We were hustling to kind of get things together because our leaders were absent.
And so this took place on Wednesday night, Thursday morning, and Friday primarily, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And then there was this weekend, and it seemed like there was a little bit of action happening in response to it nationally over the weekend, but things really sort of came to the fore yesterday. Like, did you anticipate how fast this and far that this tactic would spread?
We were actually not anticipating this. For us, when we were organizing it, we had no idea that there would be a national response to this. I mean, it's obviously very beautiful and inspiring that so many universities across the United States are now mobilized. But we were definitely not ready for the attention or the responsibility. Of course, this doesn't mean that we don't want to help anyone who reaches out to us. We've been in conversations with plenty of organizations from other universities and are happy to make our resources available as we can. But just to reiterate that we were definitely not anticipating this kind of attention.
Yeah. How are you all dealing with that? I guess that's a big question, but I imagine it's a lot of pressure all of a sudden on a relatively small group of student activists as more, you know, famous people get involved. The squad is kind of involved now, right? Because, I mean, I guess the squad was always going to be involved on some level as like the most progressive politicians in, you know, the U.S. bourgeois politics, but especially since Ilhan Omar's daughter got arrested and suspended from Barnard. But like, how are you dealing with all of that?
So we have a dedicated group of people who are in charge of press just for Columbia happenings, and they are very capable. We also provide media trainings for others who would like to be involved in the press releases. But in terms of a national response, we just communicate with other universities on a covert level, although it's actually quite hard to corral everyone in a way that legitimizes or reinforces like a strict set of OPSEC, like operational security online and on the ground, has been a bit of an issue. And it all happens out of goodwill, obviously. Like, people just want to help others who are mobilized. Sorry, guys. I'm super distracted because Mo is barking.
Oh, doggy.
So, yeah, we do have a couple of threads going online where other universities are reaching out to us in order to ask us questions. And they can range from very fundamental things like, what did we do about the bathroom situation on the camp since we were outside? Or how do we deal with people who want to be involved but have J-1 visas? That has been a very recurring question as well. So, yeah, we are just primarily organizing other universities online. Although it would be really amazing if representatives from other universities could actually come to Columbia to experience what we have made here.
So you've been talking a lot about other campuses reaching out to y'all in an effort to sort of learn from you, or to get some resources from y'all who are doing the who kicked off this wave, this new student movement. What lessons would you hope to impart to some others who are considering campus occupations, maybe who haven't yet or mm-hmm. are regrouping after theirs might have been crushed?
Yeah, I mean, here I definitely want to bring in Ben Morea's term affinity group. I think that these movements can spiral out of control very quickly. Many, many people can feel suddenly inspired, which means usually an influx of numbers into your camp. So I would really break people up into groups. Like at Columbia, when we started the encampment, we each were responsible for a certain platoon or like a certain group of people who were working together in order to achieve a set goal. So maintaining those tight affinity groups would probably be best. And actually, Ben Morea visited Columbia today to talk about his occupation in 68 of the math building on campus. And he described affinity groups as being groups where you are related to people who you trust with your life.
That is so cool that he was there. That's he invented the term affinity group, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so he did. Yeah.
To learn about that from that guy is, kind of nothing better than that, right?
Yeah, he was so excited to be back on campus. He was essentially saying that he had been waiting for 40 years to see something like this happen again, particularly because the 68 protests at Columbia were centered on the Vietnam anti-war efforts that he was very much involved in. And he said that Vietnam was the test of his generation and now Gaza is the test of our generation.
Yeah, that definitely rings very true. Thinking about the things that catalyze these kind of large movements among the youth. I hope that we can, it's scary, right? Because we really lionize the activists of the 1960s, but they did come up against a lot of limitations. And we really, really hope that we can, overcome some of those limitations. But it is scary because right, these are people we look up to. Like, what mm-hmm. makes us think that we can do it better than they could? But I don't know if it's necessarily about being better. I'm being very long-winded with this comment. That's more of a comment than a question. But like, just taking the current conditions at hand and trying to advance the struggle in some way versus where it was left in the past.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's important not to draw a complete comparison between the two movements because they are responding to two different militarized arms of the state. So like the police back then was quite different than the police right now, obviously. And Columbia definitely learned its lesson from the 68 protests it experienced, which is why we have so much security efforts being implemented on campus. But hearing Ben talk today about his experience, it was very mobilizing and inspiring. He's just such a wealth of stories. And I think the younger generation, all the undergraduate students who are in the encampment right now, who may or may not know exactly what they're getting into in terms of a potential sweep or whatever, felt so inspired just by listening to him. Someone asked him where he found the courage to do what he did, and he responded by saying, "I don't even know if courage is the right word. It's a matter of what you have to do."
Yeah. I mean, I feel that. I think it also does take a lot of courage, especially when there's a militarized police force that the president is willing to unleash on you at any time. I think it's both, right? It's having the courage to do what you know you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
But on the topic of security and, you know, what the university has learned, they really locked down the campus as soon as they possibly could, closing it to anyone without a Columbia ID. How has that impacted the efforts to organize with non-students? And what can people who don't go to Columbia, but who live in New York, what can they do? What can we do to support you and get involved?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so every day we can hear the pro-Palestinian protesters chant outside of the gates, and it really lifts the spirits of the camp. It's so important when people show up and show this report, especially because so much of the mass media is hell-bent on painting this portrait of Columbia students as deeply anti-Semitic, which is not true at all. So in terms of supporting us, please just come to campus, show up, chant outside of the gates. If we can, we will sneak you in. There are ways. In terms of the student movement and how it's responding to all of this, I think that for many of the undergraduate students, or for those who do not have extensive careers in activism, this is probably their first exposure to a quote unquote radical experience. So they are somewhat unaware that most successful protests or pro-Palestinian movements or whatnot actually proliferated in the city from non-students. And this was the case back in 68 as well, where the overwhelming response in terms of the anti-Vietnam War efforts were conducted by non-students. And then that ethos kind of matriculated at the university level when Columbia students started organizing. So something that I wish Columbia students were more aware of is that there are so many people out there who are so committed and so talented at what they do and have such a deep investment in humanity that they could really learn from them.
One thing that always seems to pop up in new movements is some sort of new mutation, some new version of the same sort of washed up outside agitator narrative. And one thing that I've been sort of looking for, or at least like maybe anticipating, is pushback against involvement from people who aren't students or something like that. Has that popped up at all in any of this?
Concerns about outside agitators?
Yeah, something to that effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a concern in any movement, regardless of whether or not it's led by students. I will say, because the students are quite green, they don't handle fear-mongering very well. So they're hyper-vigilant, and this hyper-vigilance leads them to identify random people who are just in camp or around campus as cops or like Zionists or whatever, when that's not necessarily true. And then the rumors about these people proliferate on the Signal chats, and it spooks people. So the outside agitator narrative, believe it or not, is probably manufactured first and foremost within the movement itself and proliferates in the movement itself rather than, you know, outside media.
That's interesting. I feel like we've been talking about it, at least on this podcast or amongst ourselves, as something that primarily comes from the media because they want to say, oh, you know, these people wouldn't normally be mad about this thing. These people wouldn't normally be protesting. Someone's coming in and getting them all riled up. Someone from the outside with ulterior motives, whether it's, you know, George Soros or, you know, some kind of Jewish communist Antifa conspiracy. But yeah, there's a lot of different ways that these operate.
Yeah, definitely.
Just on that front, one thing that I've seen circulating a lot on Twitter is just discourse surrounding the fact that like a lot of these occupations are using the same cheap Walmart tents, you know, like students want to do an occupation. So they like look up on Google Maps, like tents for sale, and then they go and buy the cheapest one. And they're all the exact same funny green, like Ozark Trail or Coleman fucking $30 tent. And you go on Twitter and all of these like quasi mainstream right-wing influencers are just running off to the hills, like on like sort of unable to comprehend like a natural organic spread of this movement. And they like insist that it must be centralized and funded by, yeah, a Soros character or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's much easier to place the blame on an external influencer like Soros than actually believe that people have a political consciousness and, you know, are putting it to work.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to ask, so I've been reading a little bit about the 1968 occupation of Columbia, and it was really quite segregated along racial lines. At a certain point, the Black student group told the white student group, or the majority whites, it was like pretty much majority white student group, SES, to leave. They're like, get out of this building, shit's getting real. And then they decided, all right, we're going to go occupy other buildings. And, you know, in the end, the Black student group had their own deal with the administration where they all got to leave through the tunnels, and SDS did not have the same deal. And it just played out in all sorts of different ways. And, you know, this, obviously the composition of Columbia student body today is different within this movement. How are people working together across various lines of difference, whether that's, you know, racial, ethnic, religious identity, or what have you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the gifts of social media and being online so consistently, you know, starting on from the early 2000s to now, is that political education has been heightened. And I think a lot of younger people are realizing that identity politics is a bit of a sham, or it's like a form of populism that is meant to divide and conquer. So they're much more invested in working together toward a common goal, which is the liberation of Gaza and Palestine, rather than squabbling about ideological differences. Of course, there are people who will still use identity in order to distance themselves from others, and I think that's expected. But as a whole, JVP and SJP on campus have really been in a collaborative relationship that has been very fruitful.
That's fantastic to hear. So the last question that I have is, where does this movement go from here? And one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is sort of like, what would tactically successful escalations nationally look like? Where do you see the movement going from here? What would you like to see happen across the country, whether they be in campuses that have not yet but are planning on starting an occupation, or on those who are already a part of this growing student movement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so actually what we're doing at Columbia right now is we're doing teach-ins about the 68 occupation. My personal goal would be to really discuss nonviolent direct action and take note from movements such as Defend the Atlanta Forest, or even more recently, what happened at Cal Poly Humboldt. So I think there is so much potential for students to be able to be more directly engaged and show no fear toward the NYPD or the repressive and aggressive administration of Columbia.
Word.
What was inspiring to you about Cal Poly Technic?
They were just fearless. It was amazing to watch the videos of them going against the cops who were trying to bum rush the building.
Was that the one that just came out recently?
Yeah, it's the one that was recent.
I watched that video of the guy just like bonking the cop on the head with the giant water bottle over and over again. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yep, exactly.
It's pretty good.
First it was LaCroix, and now it's these 5-gallon jugs.
It's important to stay hydrated.
I mean, of course, the situation in New York is a little different because the NYPD trains with the IDF, so they're especially heinous.
Yeah, and we have a cop for mayor.
Exactly.
I was actually shocked reading about the 1968 occupation that the mayor was actually begging Colombia's president not to call in the NYPD to evict all these students from the buildings that they were occupying. I'm like, Eric Adams could never.
So C, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I just want to say, you know, stay strong, all the power to all the people.
Hell yeah.
We want to do the Patreon real quick now.
Yeah. We'll do the shout outs.
Yeah, you want to handle that big pecker?
Sure. I love it when you call me Big Pecker. My new fursona is Big Pecker, and I'm just a giant bird. I do have a tattoo of a woodpecker on my arm.
Oh, come
on. Can't really see it. From my put a bird on it. From everyone's put a bird on it era. Right next to my champagne Molotov. Yeah, that's Big Pecker. So, blah, blah, blah. Now we got to do a little housekeeping. Our show, you know what? Currently doesn't rely that much on your support because we aren't making very much money off of it. But we would love for our show to rely on your support so Andrew doesn't quit. We can give him money and we can, you know, maybe buy some better equipment and shit. You know, just all the things that a growing podcast needs. So if you sign up at patreon.com/partygirls, give us money. You will get access to our Discord community, which is filling up with really cool people, as well as we're planning some bonus content that we're excited about coming up on the show. And also, you get a shout out. You get a personal shout out from us, the Party Ooh. Girls themselves. So first we have Bigger Bird. John, just like my woodpecker that we've been talking about.
Just like you. Oh, thanks, Bigger Bird.
We've got Kyle Brown Watson. Thank you, Kyle Brown Watson. We've got Bean Blackett. Very cool name. Thank you.
Yeah.
We've got Kaysen Hudman. I hope I'm saying that right. Thank you, Kaysen. Lenny Ritchie. Thank you, Lenny Ritchie.
Hi.
And that's it for now. You too could hear your name spoken by one or both of the party girls if you sign up and give us some money, starting at just $3 a month.
Thank you all to our patrons and thank you to all of our listeners.
And can I just say something about the Discord, which is that it's starting to get pretty cool in there. And I actually just, like, somebody who joined offered to, like, do a video chat thing and explain some Python. And so I was the beneficiary of this. I got to, like, watch an exclusive member of our exclusive Discord give us exclusive knowledge on Python coding so I can build custom Reaper scripts to make the processing and mixing of these episodes go by faster. So, like, that's pretty cool. And the Discord's cool. And you probably want to be in it.
Heck yeah. It's just like the ones you're already in, but cooler and better. Haven't you ever wished that there's a secret internet just for cool people? Well, now there is. Called the Party Girls Discord.
So as C was saying, this student movement at Columbia University in New York City started late last Wednesday night. And continued on Thursday and Friday and has continued and shaped and shifted form into this week. We're now Tuesday, April 23rd, and the movement across the country is growing and the movement on Columbia campus is changing and dynamic. But I'm going to go over a brief little timeline about this. And I think it's important to remember that a lot of this comes in the immediate aftermath of the A15 actions last week. Those were sort of direct actions that were aiming to shut down the flows of capital and to do blockades at complicit organizations and institutions and companies around the world in the ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And there were dozens and dozens of actions that were organized in a decentralized way across the world, Australia, Europe, in America and a bunch of other places too, but those are the ones that come to my mind right off the top of my head. And then 2 days later, late Wednesday night, an initial occupation of about 50 tents sprung up at Columbia University called the Gaza Solidarity Encampment. And last Thursday, the 18th, the day after, the university administration brought in massive amounts of New York Police Departments, or the NYPD, to arrest the demonstrators and crush the encampment. It's important to note that these arrests marked the first time that the university has allowed the police to suppress campus protests since the 1968 demonstrations against the Vietnam War, which we'll talk about later on Party Girls.
Oh, and it's worth noting that Minouche Shafiq, the president of Columbia, who called in the NYPD to arrest the students, she's Columbia's first Muslim president, as well as the first woman president of Columbia. And she worked with the New York's black cop mayor to repress an anti-war and anti-genocide movement. Shafiq was also the youngest ever vice president of the World Bank.
What?
So, you know, representation matters.
Jesus, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just looked that up earlier. She's just trying to get by in a man's world. Okay, also among the people arrested was Irsa Hirsi, who is the daughter of Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. And Irsa was among a group of students suspended from Barnard for their participation in the protests. So after these arrests, a large group took over the West Lawn. The first encampment was on the East Lawn. A group took over the West Lawn, rallying and waiting for everyone who'd been arrested to be released. This crowd set up ad hoc community programming, like teach-ins. There was some dancing, and they gathered and distributed food and other supplies to all of the protesters. And as of now, that lawn is still occupied. I visited it the other day on Thursday, and it was really, really cool to see, especially because, you know, when I was a student at Columbia, there was nothing like this. There was absolutely nothing like this going on, to the point where I was like, all right, well, I guess I did Food Not Bombs in high school, but maybe now my thing is taking the subway downtown and going to parties. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do the next 4 years, because there ain't shit happening. But that is not the case anymore. It was so, 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 so cool to see. So a number of people, influential people, I don't know if I'd call them influencers, because that term is stupid. But yeah, some leftist influential types, like the Reverend Cornel West, showed up to show solidarity. It's starting to attract a lot of media attention. It's getting bigger. It's growing. And all the protesters who were arrested by the NYPD were released by the evening. This is still Thursday evening that we're talking about. Fast forward to Monday, hundreds of faculty members walked out of their classes in solidarity with the protesters and in objection to the administration's handling of the protests.
Meanwhile, this movement has multiplied and spread to campuses across the entire country. As of Monday, April 22nd, protest camps were set up at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, Emerson College, University of Michigan, New York University or NYU, Yale, the New School, and Cal Polytechnic in Humboldt County. And I'm sure I'm missing some. Monday night, Cal Polytechnic blockades the doors of Siemens Hall. Hope I'm saying that word right, an administrative building on campus. And the police responded with violence, cracking open one of the students' heads.
I saw that picture. It's so gnarly.
It's gnarly. That picture will not be in the show notes. One protester wielding an empty 5-gallon jug, one of those big plastic, massive 5-gallon jugs, just like bonks a cop on the head repeatedly, like thunk, thunk, thunk. And eventually the riot police were called off. Students retook the building. And as far as I understand, the vibes there were joyous. They were brave. They were committed. This represents the first confrontational building occupation of this wave of student demonstrations that's been in solidarity with Palestine. It's important to note that all of these other occupations have essentially been on the quads of campuses, and they might call them something different here or there, but it's the main quad, the main gathering area folks will get their little tents and they'll set them up. But this one in Cal Polytechnic in the good state of California took over a building, forcing the police off campus. That's a great achievement in this age of police militarization. But it's not the first time this century that student movements have employed these tactics. We'll talk about that more in a bit.
We sure as hell will. Also on Monday, the NYPD, that fucking NYPD, they're just everywhere. They're all over New York City, baby, like a fascist occupying force. It's right there in the name. They cracked down on the occupation that had bloomed at NYU. And I was down there earlier in the day, and it was a very joyful, joyful event, completely nonviolent. It was like the only reason you would be threatened by this is if, you know, you just can't handle dissent. You can't handle people standing up and saying what they believe. So it was peaceful for most of the day. And then later at night, the NYPD, you know, they'd had enough. They cracked down on the occupation. There was a line of teachers who had formed to try to protect the students who were protesting in Gould Plaza. And this is a tactic that we have that we saw in the 1960s as well. We'll talk about that in a minute. I think it's the most natural impulse in the world for teachers to want to protect their students, right? Because those are your kids and you don't want the cops to beat them up. But the cops used violence. They used pepper spray. There was multiple reports of people being pepper sprayed. And the cops broke through the line of teachers and arrested over 100 people, both teachers and students.
And finally, yesterday, we saw the encampment spread to Rochester University, the University of New Mexico, Pittsburgh, several locations in Texas. By several different reliable sources, these are folks who are very involved in social movements. There's been over 20 Gaza Solidarity encampments or liberated zones since Colombia kicked off the first one just 5 days ago.
That's so lit.
That's so lit. All power to the communes, all power to the occupations. Godspeed, my brethren.
That's so good. It's really inspiring to see and hear about this happening. And I'll save most of my analysis for later in the episode. But I have a little bit of history as well, because this is not the first time that this has happened, and it's not the first time that it's happened at Columbia. So in 1968, students all over the world, and particularly for the purposes of this episode, at Columbia University in the city of New York, took over college campuses to protest against the Vietnam War, in favor of civil rights, and against capitalism and imperialism writ large, as well as many particular, more local issues that touched off these occupations. So yeah, the backdrop that you need to have for this is, you know, this was a time in 1968, people were increasingly frustrated with the Vietnam War abroad. And the Columbia occupation kicked off just a few weeks after Martin Luther King was assassinated, which was an event that touched off riots in cities all over the country, including in New York, including in Harlem, where Columbia is basically located. I mean, they call the neighborhood where Columbia is Morningside Heights, but it's, you know, very, very Harlem adjacent. So this started initially on Tuesday, April 23rd, 1968, 56 years ago today, the day that we are recording this episode. It started off as an SDS demo in Lo Plaza over the plans to construct a new gym in Morningside Heights, which was one of few public parks available to the community around the university. And they made this plan with the city, the college did, that is, without consulting anyone in the majority Black community of Harlem that, you know, had a stake in what happened to this park. So they were also protesting the suspension of some students who protested inside a building, because protesting inside a building was against the rules in 1968 at Columbia and probably still is today. Haven't checked on that. And what they were protesting was the Institute for Defense Analysis, which was a secret research group concerned with counterinsurgency tactics, both here at home and in Latin America, that was working with the CIA. And at first, you know, no one would even admit that this program existed, but eventually they're like, yeah, okay, we exist. So the plan was to march into Low Library, demand that these students be reinstated, and that they stop the construction of this gym, which was nicknamed the Jim Crow Gym. So the administration usually relied on a sizable population of conservative jocks and athletes to, as well as business students, to guard buildings and tamp down on these protests. But that day, for whatever reason, they weren't really out in full force. So the students marched to Low Library. They found it was locked. They marched to the park for a bit. They got attacked by the police. They came back to campus. And then they're like, fuck it. We're taking over Hamilton Hall. And even more so, we're taking the dean hostage, because it was really easy to take the dean hostage on that particular day. They just kind of, because he was already there in his office in Hamilton Hall. So they just kind of, you know, stood in the doorway and told him he couldn't leave. And they were like, look, we got Harry S. Coleman, we got the dean. And in order, for a show of good faith, we want the administration to agree to at least our first demand, which was amnesty for the students who got suspended for protesting the CIA program. And then they would release the dean. And more students started seeing this was happening. They were like, oh, well, we're going to join you. And by the evening, there was a pretty large crew of students in this building, including a large contingent of Black students who arrived, as well as Black militants from the New York City area who wanted to protest this gym particularly, and, you know, racism more generally. But the gym really became a stand-in for that in this particular struggle. So the next day, the Black students asked the white students of SES to leave. They said, we're taking over the show to take care of business. And a small sign went up in the panes of the building door announcing that this was now the Malcolm X building of Malcolm X University, AD 1968. So the white students left and they took over some other buildings, including the presidential suite in Low Library, where they smoked the president's cigars. So members of the Black students group, SAS, announced on the radio that there had been guns in the building, but they asked some of the militants from outside the university to remove them, and they did. This is, I think, it shows how Black militants, including members of the Black Panther Party, really respected the students' leadership here. They did not come in and try to take it over and be the leaders. So yeah, time goes on. There's a lot of media showing up. And the Black students decide to let in the media selectively in a certain order of things, prioritizing Black journalists, Black outlets, and deprioritizing outlets that were basically racist, right-wing and racist. So by now, both the Black students and the white students have formulated their demands. And they're a little different, but they're asking essentially for the same things. And the demands were that all the work on the Columbia gym stops immediately, that the CIA program has to be canceled. The CIA is canceled. The six students involved in demonstrating against that CIA program must not be suspended. And they wanted amnesty for everybody who was involved in the current occupation and demonstration. Okay, so this is an interesting thing because the cops played a 100% negative role in the Columbia occupation of today so far. But in 1968, there was the specter of riots still in the neighborhood if the cops did anything to further inflame racial tensions, if they mistreated the Black students and the Black groups and the Black people on campus. So there was almost a violent confrontation between the right-wing jocks and a number of Black groups who wanted to get onto campus. And the cops actually made the right-wing jocks stand aside and let the Black groups in. Then what happened? SDS took over the mathematics building, which became sort of the most militant building on campus in this occupation. We talked a little bit about Ben Morea in our interview earlier. He was part of Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker, which was a very radical anarchist group. He was involved in that building. The faculty, they tried to form a chain to protect students in Low Library, and they got completely brutalized by the police, much like what just happened at NYU. So Friday, a bunch of high school kids from Harlem came to campus, and immediately after that, the university instituted this IDs-only campus lockdown. So that it took them a few days in 1968. It took them no time at all this time around. Around 3:30 p.m. on Friday, Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael showed up and read some demands. Brown said, "These are our demands. One, if the Jim Crow gym in Morningside is built, it will be blown up." Yeah, that's right. Did he stutter? They're going to blow that shit up. Two, amnesty for all students participating in these demonstrations here at Columbia. Three, the Institute for Defense Analysis must go. It is a tool of the government, the racist government, to suppress the poor peoples of the world, Latin America, and the ghettos of this country. If the university meets the first two demands, then the Black students will negotiate the third. If the university refuses to deal with us, with the Black brothers inside this building, then they had better be prepared to deal with the Black brothers in the streets. So that's a very explicit threat to further unrest and riots. And it seems like that exerted quite a bit of influence over the university. So on Friday, the university rescinds their call to the police and shuts down for the weekend. They're like, "No, never mind. We're canceling you. I know we said to come, but no." And a lot of cool, interesting things happened over the weekend. Women were allowed to do security after some discussion over whether or not that would be appropriate. And young women from other schools, not just Barnard, but, you know, Sarah Lawrence and other colleges had come climbed in the windows by this point and were involved. Men and women cooked together, again, being very, very woke about gender for 1968. They desegregated the gendered restrooms. So, you know, now we have some all gender restrooms where people of all genders can go. So fast forward to Sunday, the jocks finally got their shit together to form a blockade to keep food from getting into Low, the occupied Low building.
Jesus, what are these knuckleheads' problem?
No, it's crazy. Like, I mean, it's good that there's not an army of right-wing jocks now, right, like fighting the campus occupiers, jocks and business students. But I guess they really wanted their gym. What else can you say? So in response to this, yeah, people were very concerned that the occupation would get discouraged if they knew that food wasn't getting into Low. So people came and tossed food into the open windows, and the people on the inside caught it. I guess it's like sandwiches and fruit and stuff, and, you know, nothing messy, right? So the jocks were trying to keep people from throwing food into the open windows, right? To keep up their, like, fucking blockade of this building. But the cops, again, the cops stepped in and they're like, "No, no, no, guys, just let them throw the food in the windows." So again, an interesting instance where the cops were
so strange. It's like, it's, I could never imagine that happening today.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I guess to some level, to some degree, the cops were just trying to maintain order and keep things from getting too violent, except when they decided that they were going to do the violence, right? It's like, well, now it's time for us to do our thing. We have the state monopoly on violence, after all. So yeah, the cops, they're not the good guys in this story, don't worry. So the first report of an impending police bust came around 10 p.m. on Monday. And Mayor Lindsay actually made a final telephone call to the president of Colombia, Grayson Kirk, around this time, begging him not to request the police to eject the students. Again, who's the mayor now? Fucking Eric Adams. Can you see him making a phone call like that? No, I don't think so. So the faculty formed a ring to protect the students in the buildings, and a lot of them got brutalized by the police, including some of the most popular and decorated professors at Columbia University. You know, people with tenure, people with like a very long name to their chair. They got fucked up, and there were some serious injuries there. One student even lost an eye. Someone had their shoulder dislocated, and you know, a lot of professors just had their heads bleeding. It was really bad. So now things are drawing to a close, and everyone just kind of wants to figure out how to get out of this with as little danger to themselves as possible. So the university was really afraid of riots in the Black neighborhood around the university because, you know, again, the MLK assassination had just happened and caused riots already. So the university made a deal with the Black students to let them leave peacefully through the tunnels under the university. Everyone else was just kind of, you know, beaten, evicted, arrested. In all, 628 people were arrested, and at which point the majority of the faculty voted to walk out on strike. So classes were called off for the remainder of the academic year in all of this chaos. In the end, they got a lot of what they were gunning for. Columbia ended the program with the CIA, and they scrapped the plans for the Jim Crow gym. Instead, they built sort of an underground fitness center, which, yeah, they like, why the fuck did you need to do that in Morningside Park to begin with? It was just pretty fucking tone deaf and stupid of them in the first place. 30 students were suspended. They didn't get every single one of their demands met because they wanted amnesty for everybody participating. But there were a number of long-term effects in addition to what happened in the short term. A lot of people blame this for sort of the wokeification of the academy, which I think is pretty funny. And, you know, if that is true, I think that's an example of the academy sort of trying to recuperate this radical energy that erupted around issues of, you know, white supremacy, capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. They're like, well, you know, we're not going to stop being that evil, but maybe we'll do like an African-American studies department or something. So I had a couple takeaways from this before we go back to our wide angle episode. Yeah, I think the particular demands are not always the most important thing, right? Because it was about a program that really didn't encompass that many people. As scary as it is to see, you know, any degree of cooperation with the CIA, it was a relatively small program. And the gym, you know, that was an important local issue. But, you know, there were certainly a lot of other issues on people's minds at that point in time. And it stood for a lot of other things. So I think sometimes the particular demands are maybe not the most important thing. And I think now, if we want to compare it to today, the particular demands here are also, they're certainly a little more direct, speaking more directly to these big world events on people's minds right now, right? Because it's about the war in Gaza. But, you know, whether or not Columbia University individually divests from the war machine is not going to stop the war, right? But, you know, if an encampment, if an occupation blooms around this demand and it spreads to every campus and every campus divests, and this causes some sort of political crisis, you know, every college in the U.S. is just in turmoil. Classes are online, classes are canceled, people want their money back. That creates enough of a political crisis to put pressure on the government, I think, to really maybe actually do something here.
You hit the nail on the head where it's like, what's actually important in these moments? And this is where a lot of the ultra left nerds come in, where it's like, what's actually important in these moments isn't the purity of the language of the demands, it's the tactics that are employed and how they can, how contagious they can become. And like, in order to bring into being exactly what you're talking about, a nationwide movement, there needs to be tactics that are reproducible, that are inspiring, that are accessible, and that are also have a clear path towards escalation.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's all I have on the 60s. Do you want to fast forward in time to 2008?
Sure. Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about a more recent student movement. I do think it's important to note that a lot of historians consider what happened at Columbia in 1968 to be one of the most significant historical events in American higher educational history, and certainly American higher educational protest history. And I don't think it can be overstated the influence that this had on the nation. 1968 was, as folks might know, an extremely insurgent year. There's all these parallels that one could feel with 2024. But another thing that occurred in 1968 was the, you know, Chicago Democratic National Convention and riots around the entire country after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, and even further afield in France, we had student demonstrations that managed to pull in other layers of society and become a fucking general strike, which is, God, that's really the shining beacon in so many of our brains to this day, because it's one of the only times in history that that has happened. And unfortunately, in the US, the student movement did not pull in as much of the workers' movement for a lot of different reasons, including the fact that organized labor was a little reactionary in 1968, and a lot of them were not against the Vietnam War. But I still think we need to be looking to organized labor, particularly workers in essential sectors of the economy, who can organize to shut shit down. And I'm not just talking about the regular union bureaucracy, the regular labor bureaucracy, right? Because a lot of the time, workers who want to do really radical shit have to fight their own unions as well.
Yes. If the worker will be a revolutionary subject in the 21st century, we will wait and see. But in 2008, folks might recall, there was a giant financial crisis sweeping the world, obviously the fault of the elites and the bankers on Wall Street. And many universities across the world responded to the economic crisis with austerity and with cuts, as do all people in positions of power when faced with that question. But I'm going to read a little bit of an account that was from a participant in the occupations in New York City in 2008 to 2009, as well as a few other things. But in December of 2008, the month of the Greek Rebellion in Greece, the widely hated president of the New York City's New School for Social Research fired the provost and appointed himself. He also cut the library in half, shut down a building where students gathered, and raised tuition. So student campus activists, sort of SDS, and other sort of activist groups like that wanted to wait for the right time, you know, sort of like the movement's not ready, we need more numbers, et cetera, et cetera. But the more autonomous and initiative-taking sectors thought otherwise. So after two grueling meetings at nighttime in December, 30 students, only 30, and not students and non-students, and that's important too, took the first floor of 65 Fifth Avenue smack dab in the middle of Manhattan, blocking the doors with chairs, tables, and trash cans from the cafeteria. Within hours, hundreds of people came out in support, and students who, until then, had only read Hegel were now fighting security guards with tables and blocking the streets outside. This lasted from Wednesday night to Friday morning. your sort of authoritarian groups issued demands while the more autonomous sectors conspired to bring more people in and to expand the occupation. At key moments, even against the sort of like formal consensus of some of the people, friends outside were broken into the building with spectacular actions. A Greek solidarity march came by and livened up the party with 100 more anarchists. The president was chased down the street to his home and conceded to some of the demands soon after. New York University, NYU, joined the wave and occupied their student building in February. After a massive street conflict outside and 3 days barricaded inside the buildings, the people left with no charges. A few weeks went by and the admin thought that the activists had given up, but in the middle of the night, they seized a whole building with only 19 people. Once again, students and non-students. This is a theme that we'll see in every effective student movement. It's the composition between the university and the communities in which they're situated. And we resist any attempt to like falsely separate those two things. The administration responded with extreme aggression and more than 200 cop cars, along with helicopters, hordes of SWAT, the fucking Joint Terrorism Task Force, and other teams shut down multiple streets and all of Union Square. It took them 7 hours to chainsaw their way into the building. People outside attempted to cause a sort of distraction so the occupiers could escape, but they weren't able to do that. And the occupation ended before the supporters outside could successfully start a riot. But that action sent shockwaves across the nation. The following September, people at UC Santa Cruz took things up a notch, occupying the student center for a week. This time with no demands, and then seizing two massive buildings for over a week in November. UC Davis, UCLA, SFSU, and Berkeley were all occupied after that, raising the bar each time. And afterwards, it seemed that there were only two options left: shut down more universities with multiple occupations, or extend the struggle to the city and continue it there. And I think that's a good pivot into where we are again today, is we're sort of left with two options: shut down more universities with multiple occupations and or extend the struggle into the city and continue it there.
Hell yeah. Well, what happened in 2010? They did exactly that when a group of activists decided to do a little thing called Occupy Wall Street in Zuccotti Park, in downtown Manhattan. And, you know, for all its faults, that movement definitely restarted things a little bit in this country, because, you know, going in, you gotta remember, or if you weren't old enough, I'll tell you, it was a pretty bleak place for anyone who considered themselves an anti-capitalist, right? Like, you know, we were in the fucking Obama years. He was like, don't worry, guys, I got this. And then he immediately bailed out the banks and not the homeowners. So many people lost their homes in this subprime mortgage crisis. New York had it was just a fucking Death Star of capitalist empire. There was an army of militarized police. And, you know, the idea that you could do anything to stand up to any of it, even something that was admittedly kind of cringe at times, was pretty new. It was pretty fresh in the world. So I think it was Matt Chrisman who said that, you know, Occupy had to post cringe so that people could start imagining a better world again. I'm probably fucking up that. I'm paraphrasing it. But I feel like that's kind of exactly what happened. And maybe now we can skip over the posting cringe part, and just get to imagining a better world and doing stuff, extending it into the city for sure. So let's compare and contrast what's happening right now with some of these past occupations that we've talked about on this episode, right? So in 2008, I think it's fair to say that the New School students went extremely hard over things like raised tuition and a shut down building, right? Like they hard occupied this building and really physically engaged the police and security over some things that are, you know, perhaps minor in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, from there, they somersaulted to some really maximalist demands, like, you know, abolish the fucking value form. Like, not all the new school students, but definitely a contingent of them. So, you know, by comparison, I think the students at Columbia and other schools in New York right now have sort of been relatively pacifist compared to that, despite being animated by a much more dire, pressing, and unifying issue. Right. No buildings have been taken so far on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And, you know, the forces of recuperation are already trying to pull these movements in their direction. And I don't see this as a conspiracy on the part of any individuals. You know, I think everyone in the squad who tweeted their support is probably a good person who means well, particularly Rashida Tlaib. I have got a soft spot for her. Like, sorry. But, you know, on the wider angle, it is a problem if bourgeois politicians get involved. And calling them bourgeois politicians is not a value judgment on them as people. It's just a literal description of the position they occupy. So I guess my question is, you know, how do partisans from within and without the student body of these various encampments, how do they escalate things in a really conflictual anti-capitalist, anti-empire direction without alienating people who might otherwise be involved, be into it? How do we do that in the nicest way possible?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question that you posed about the juxtaposition between some seemingly trivial things when compared to the ongoing Holocaust and genocide going on in Gaza. I mean, I think in terms of what folks can do is, I think within this current social movement, within a lot of social movements, there's always a sort of knee-jerk reaction by a lot of people to even hard leftists and anarchists to sort of say, okay, well, who's actually the people who get to make the decisions about where this movement goes? And oftentimes that question, if it's answered at all publicly, will be based on some sort of large consensus thing or something like that, with either grueling meetings or coalitions with a bunch of people who have very different politics from one another. I think that the move for students who want to take things further is to just do it, is to find a group of 19 people between your friends and their friends and their friends on and off campus and go and take a building and to publicize the shit out of it and to have ways for other homies to join in. You don't need anyone's permission to do that. And any group that's like seriously committed to ending the genocide in Gaza will not talk shit about y'all for not getting their permission first. Like, this movement to end the genocide in Gaza needs everybody's involvement, and it needs everybody doing whatever it is that they do best to the maximum of their capacities. And that's not going to look like trying to get permission from as many people as you possibly can before doing something. It's doing something that makes sense to you. It's learning how to do it, how you get into a building, and do it. So for example, if there was a march, if there was an action, before your march, have someone go to the building on campus, whether it be a cafeteria or an administrative building. Those are probably your best two bets. The cafeteria, because you can liberate the food, you can serve people, you can try to repurpose some of the cooking infrastructure to actually feed people and have this really cool, exciting world that has the sustenance to survive. And the administrative building, because fuck the administration of your school. It doesn't matter which school you go to, fuck your administration of your school. And like, just doing it. So you have someone go into the building ahead of time, then you have a break-off march, and the march goes and it takes the building, and you drop a banner that's pre-made from the window of the building above the front door that claims the building as something new, you know? And then inside you've got food serving around the clock. You put out a call for all committed revolutionaries, anarchists, and people fighting for Palestinian liberation to come and join you, and you just do the damn thing. You know, I also think that we need to resist groups who claim to speak on behalf of anybody else. One thing that I've seen that I just saw today from, I will not name the school, but it's one of the, it's a new Instagram page that just popped up for a state school for apartheid and divesting. And they've got an infographic with what they're maintaining as their protocols for the burgeoning movement on their local campus. And it says, quote, "We will follow in the footsteps of other university campuses and maintain peaceful, minimally disruptive presence to other students," end quote. It says that in their tactical strategy for their infographic. And then finally, it says, as the quote, "As the university is an institution which employs great violence, do not engage with hecklers or police and comply if told to leave."
What?
End quote. No, do not do that. Do not listen to the police, because the police are defending American empire, the people who are committing the genocide in Gaza. If your strategy is premised on obeying the orders of the police, you are not going to win anything worth fighting for in this world.
Yeah, fuck no. And if you see that shit, like, don't be afraid to say what you think people should do instead, right? Like, there's going to be all different factions in a movement like this. There's going to be libs wringing their hands over, oh, no, we should follow the rules and not be too disruptive. And then there's going to be other people who want to escalate it and take it further in ways that actually do disrupt and therefore are more effective. And you can circulate your own ideas. You can circulate your own literature. Like, there is a little zine that was written by some participants in the student movement and put out by Ill Will Editions. And I was passing them out. I wasn't the only one. Students were passing them out too. But, you know, it is an all hands on deck situation.
And what's that zine called?
It's called First We Take Columbia.
Oh, yeah, that's a good name. That's a good name.
First We Take Columbia, lessons from the April 1968 occupations movement. And it distills down a lot of what we've been talking about on this episode, as it turns out. It takes its name from a poem called Revolutionary Letter Number 15 by Diane de Prima. It's super good. Yeah, and it, I mean, basically, the primary takeaway from this is take a building. Just fucking do it. Don't have endless meetings about it. You know, you should definitely have some kind of agreement between a group of people before you do that. But just fucking do it. Just do it. Do the thing. And you'll figure it out as you go along.
You don't need permission of whoever has the megaphone. You don't need permission of whatever student group some people might think is in charge of the protest. In order for our movement to win, in order to stop the genocide in Gaza, everybody must act. And there's no gatekeeper of who, of what an effective, of what is a legitimate act or who is a legitimate actor. We need to escalate this movement into all aspects of everyday life. The function of the occupation is to disrupt the regular functioning of the university. That's the only purpose of it, is to shut the university down. So you, in order to do that, you need to have the infrastructure to sustain. Doing so outside in your shitty little $30 Walmart tents will be a lot harder and less comfortable than in a building that has air conditioned and floors and bathrooms and walls and tables and chairs and different rooms. It'll be much easier inside those buildings. It'll be more accessible for people who have special like requirements, like maybe they have insomnia, maybe they've got like they don't want to be sleeping outside, maybe the weather gets to them, things like that. We got a word for that, y'all. It's called shelter, and it's fucking fire.
You hear? It's ableist to not take a building. If you don't take over a building, you are excluding your comrades who are disabled by insomnia and other physical limitations. So there you go.
I've got some last words, if that's...
Yeah, man, give it to us. Jerry's final thought.
So we're at a pivotal moment in this burgeoning student movement. The movement will either continue to spread, grow, innovate, build across difference, such as between the university and the community in which it is situated, all while experimenting with the escalation towards more durable and militant tactics, or it won't do that. I will offer a quote from the first revolutionary communist zine that I was given as a tender 18-year-old freshman when I attended Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, written in 2009, called Communique for an Absent Future. Quote, "To accomplish our goals, we cannot rely on those groups which position themselves as our representatives. We are willing to work with unions and student associations when we find it useful, but we do not recognize their authority. We must act on our own behalf directly, without mediation. We must break with any group that seeks to limit the struggle by telling us to go back to class, go back to work, to negotiate, or to reconcile." End quote. This could be the beginnings of a long, hot summer here in the United States of America. In order to stop the genocide in Gaza, we must shut down the flows of everyday life and reproduction here in the imperial core. We must attack the war machine from within with a war machine of our own. For that is what we are in, comrades, a war against the most powerful military in human history, the most powerful empire the world has ever seen. Do not ask yourself how you can get plugged in to what is already happening. Ask yourself how you can participate in shaping what comes next. We'll see you on the barricades. Party Girls out.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.